Hello, I'm John Chambers, and I want to welcome you to another session of Chambers Talks. It's a discussion about tech disruption and how that changes every aspect of our business. I think with AI suddenly hitting new heights of excitement, we're realizing this change is going to take place at an even faster pace than we originally envisioned. Each of these sessions, we try to get a leader, usually a very good friend, who I've known that can add value to the discussion and that in many ways can teach us all on the broadcast lessons learned, where they see the world going, the economy, and how technology plays a role in it. This is something that I'm excited about today because I have one of my great friends, and Ajay and I have known each other for, I think, well over 15 years. We share a common vision about what the US-India could do on strategic partnerships. Ajay was also an extremely successful leader, CEO for MasterCard for over 10 years, and prior to that, COO at the organization. He believes in giving back and Cyber Readiness Institute and empower small and medium-sized businesses and enterprise to really think about how do you change their future. He's on the board of directors and board of advisors of many organizations around the world. He led the US-India Strategic Partnership Forum and Business Council prior to me taking on the chairmanship role. He recruited me for the role, and Ajay, it's something I really want to thank you about. It's been probably one of the most enjoyable things I've ever done as the US and India became the most strategic alliances in the world together. And we saw that with the announcement with Prime Minister Modi and with President Biden earlier this last summer. You are somebody that I think articulates kind of our future and direction. You assume the leadership of the World Bank on June 2nd, 2023. So we can cover everything from the economy to politics to technology as we go forward. And Ajay, as your friend, I want to thank you for being on our podcast today.
Thank you, John, for having me. And thank you once again for what you did at the US-India Forum. I think you transformed the place and the relationship, and you bear that very lightly, but you did a great job.
Well, you're being very kind. I think you got us through phase one and phase two, and I got us through phase three and four, and then the next generation will get us through phase five. But for the listeners, you can see our chemistry is good. We obviously have a great time together and respect each other in terms of what we've been able to accomplish. Maybe on the first set, let's talk about leadership lessons learned. Then in the second set, we might have questions and ideas, jump into the World Bank. And then the third is just, yeah, and how do you begin to scale the opportunities and challenges we see in front of us? When you think about all of your years of leadership and experience, what are the top characteristics, Ajay, you see in successful leaders? And how has that changed as we've seen the speed of innovation actually accelerate and looks like really accelerate with AI?
So, John, I think that really successful leaders are people who get people to follow them, not because of the role they occupy, but because of what they do and how they do it. And I think there's not enough attention paid to the what and the how as compared to the chair that you occupy. And, you know, if you're able to do things with a sense of humor and a sense of humility, and you care about what you do and how you do it, you can get a lot of people to follow you in the direction you're going. You have to have those two characteristics of humor and humility. Humility so that you're constantly communicating in as simple a way and learning from the people as you go along. And humor, because humor allows you to make even difficult conversations relatively easy for people to stay with you. And you will have difficult conversations when you're a leader. As you know well, you're an outstanding leader and you've led Cisco through many years of what it did and transformed itself. And you had to have difficult conversations. But humor and humility together with what you do and how you do is kind of, I think, the most important set of traits. And then I think the second category is that the idea that you can learn something from everybody is connected to the humility. But in addition to that, that you can translate that learning into actionable things that others can follow and get done to scale and replicate. Because scaling and replicating is how you win. And I think what's changed over the last few years with the way in which technology is driving innovation and change is that the change cycle has got faster. The only thing that's constant is change. And now it's not just change, but it's the speed of change. And I think to be able to think with a sense of urgency, to be able to think with the willingness to take thoughtful risks, to be able to think that you can't do it all, so you have to empower people and then hold them accountable, that set of characteristics has got exacerbated by the speed of change. Urgency, thoughtful risk-taking, and empowerment accountability, I think, have just got further turbocharged with what's going on with the speed of change.
You know, I'm going to stay with the first point that you raised, first group, which is both a sense of humor and humility. I've seen many great leaders around the world, but often the ones that are the best are also the most effective in terms of connectivity with the humility side of the house. And Ajay, you're a great example of that. But we've also seen that with Prime Minister Modi, for example, in India, and other leaders around the world who have been very good in business. You know, I use the example of Walmart, where their leaders have always been extremely humble. The other one I had not heard before, and boy, it makes all the sense in the world, humor. And why is that so important, and how you're able to deliver tough messages with a softness that others expect. So for the viewers, this is one that I will have in my top characteristics of leaders going forward, but Ajay, one that I hadn't done before. The leader's job set the vision and strategy for the organization, whether it's World Bank, MasterCard, USISPF, et cetera. The ability to deliver on that strategy is the team that you build around you. What are perhaps the top two or three lessons the audience may not automatically come to mind when you think about building great teams and your lessons learned there?
So I think the first thing, John, is that you should look on the fact that your team should be smarter than you. When you put their assets together and their talents together and their skills and their life experiences, they should fill you out. They should expand on who you are. And so I think when people speak to diversity, they tend to very quickly talk about diversity of look and ethnicity and gender. And I speak of diversity of experiences and skills and upbringing. And so if you surround yourself with people who don't look like you, don't walk like you, don't talk like you, didn't go to the same schools as you, didn't work in the same companies as you, then you will surround yourself with people whose life experiences and capabilities go beyond yours. And finding a way to do that is one of the best ways to make yourself successful, because then you add value to yourself every minute of every day at every table that you sit at with this fabulous team that you've built. So that's kind of the most important thing to me. Surround yourself with people different from you and truly different in how they grew up and what they did and their experiences. The second thing is that chemistry is kind of important, and people mistake chemistry for agreement. And I think agreement is the wrong form of chemistry. Real chemistry is trust. And trust includes the ability to disagree on certain things, but disagree in a way that is constructive. You know, when you and I were doing things together, we may not always have agreed, but the ability to do so with trust, knowing that John will not misunderstand my disagreement to be disloyalty or to be not being concerned for what he should do to be successful, that's kind of important. I have to feel I can give you my opinion, and you have to feel that by doing so doesn't change our relationship. And I think that chemistry is as important as that first attribute of surrounding yourself with people who don't look like you and walk like you and didn't have the same experiences. Because if you don't have the trust, they won't feel free to speak up. And I think the last thing I'd speak about in a team is the feeling that you're kind of in it together. So shared goals and shared visions are kind of important. You know, you can disagree on how to get there, but if you disagree on where you're going, you know, the old saying about you got to skate to where the puck is going. Well, if you can't figure out where the puck is going, you're not going to get there together. And I think having a shared vision, a shared comprehension with different perspectives on the most efficient, the most effective way of getting there, that's okay. That's vision. That's a way of speaking differently. But you must have the right direction of where you'd like to go. So I think these three attributes are really important in a good team.
You know, I could not agree with you more, Ajay. I articulate some of the views with a little bit different background on it, but I think our currency as leaders is relationships that we have, our track record, and then trust. But the common history for the listeners, trust is what allows you to move with speed and confidence of the group. And to get trust, you've got to be able to disagree and to learn from each other in that process. I don't know if you remember, but we were crossing paths in an airport in India one day, and I was going out in a plane. I think you were coming in or vice versa. And you told me about the partnership you were trying to form between the U.S. India together, and you were really excited about it. And when you did the overview, I just began to understand what was possible. And then later, next time we talked, you recruited me to become part of your vision on it. How did you know almost 10 years ago that the U.S. and India could do something partnership-wise way beyond just businesses and creating good economic and trade issues? You grasped that before almost anyone else did. Is there something takeaway here that others can have for how you envision a future and then a plan to get there that we can learn from?
But the specific case of US and India, I think I was a little advantaged in having grown up and studied and worked in India for the first 15 years of my life. And then having had the good fortune to come and live overseas in Europe first and then the US and Asia. And I think that gave me a perspective, John, that gave me an advantage over others who may not have seen the commonality that existed between these two incredible democracies. So I think there's a specific thing about the US-India part of it that benefited a guy in my background. But you asked a deeper question and take a bet on it and see patterns that may make sense. And I think you've got a lot of that too. So if you treat this as a conversation between the two of us who've got the idea on this, I think there are two things that matter. One is you have to be willing to be contrarian.
Yes.
Because if all you're doing is what everybody else has already figured out, there isn't a lot different in what you're going to see. And you are that. You are contrarian. You're pushing the boundary with new ideas. And you've always been that way. Because if you'd just been the guy who followed the trend, how would you ever have done with Cisco what you did? Even forget about your new life and your new avatar, where you're reinventing entrepreneurship and innovation in so many ways. Just the fact that you're involved with that makes you contrarian. And so I think contrarian, being a person who questions everything always, is really important. Because that's when you break down established ways of thinking and you start worrying about, hey, what am I missing? The second little piece is the willingness to take a risk. So you're never going to have perfect information, John.
Yes.
But the absence of perfect information is also where the arbitrage of success is. And so if everybody had perfect information, there is no arbitrage. And so the willingness to take that risk, to take that plunge and stick your neck out a little and not be scared of the mistake you might make by doing so. You know, when I was talking about the US-India partnership, it was actually 14, 15 years ago. It is when the partnership was at its bottom.
Yes.
And my logic was that these two democracies are too similar to not be each other's partner. And India was in a geopolitical and geographic location where America with its values and India with its values necessarily should be partners for the future of the growth of Asia. And when you put those two thoughts together and you add to that the manner in which the Indian population admires and respects the United States as a place to send their children to study, as a place to send people to work, and as a place to copy capitalist ideas from, even if you interpret them differently and you execute them in a way that is suitable for India's economic environment, then you see that there is a commonality and a common thread there that goes well beyond what may at that time have put the two countries in two different places. In the same way, seeing the pattern, being contrarian, but taking the risk to go out. Those are the two things I would say are kind of important if you're going to look out beyond a corner and see what's coming.
You know, I'm going to move over to a different stream of thoughts here. And by the way, the first section, it was just Reef and Ajay. The second stream of thoughts is around the World Bank and how you get to see what's going on globally in a way that almost no one else does. And yet many people on this podcast who are listening may not really understand what the World Bank does. Could you kind of educate us just with a, you know, a quick elevator pitch on what is it that the World Bank does? And then secondly, what are your priorities for the World Bank in terms of what do you want to see them evolve and key priorities for the future?
So the World Bank is a multilateral development institution, meaning it's funded by many countries in the world. In this case, 199 countries are members, but the richer world tends to provide more of the capital and funding. And that money is then taken, leveraged in the bond markets with a AAA rating that we enjoy, to raise many multiples of that capital and put that capital to work to help change outcomes on education, healthcare, infrastructure, digitization, planet, climate mitigation, jobs, economic policy, the kinds of things that make a country develop. The bank has five institutions inside it. The one that lends to the most disadvantaged countries is called the International Development Agency, IDA. It basically gives money at grant or very deeply concessional money for long-term lending. What do I mean by very deeply concessional? 10 and 20 basis points of charge for 30, 40 years of lending. So, I mean, it's basically grant money. Think of this as going to now countries in Africa, which need the help, but till some years ago, countries in Asia and Latin America as well. As time has gone by, those countries have graduated. There are fewer in Asia and Latin America still getting money from IDA. There are more in Africa. The second big part of the bank is the International Bank of Reconstruction and Development, IBRD. This is what lends money at close to market rates, but still cheaper than what you would have paid in a country to the sovereign for these lower middle income and middle income countries as they're graduating out and trying to develop their economies. So India, the country we were talking about, is today one of the largest IBRD clients. It used to be China some years ago. China has progressed past that stage. India is rushing towards that, but is today still at that category, as an example. The third category is the International Financial Corporation, IFC. That's what works with the private sector to crowd in private sector money into areas where maybe they wouldn't have gone by themselves, but the IFC can take a pole position, can put a stamp of good housekeeping, can help to ensure that projects that should be funded in renewable energy, in healthcare, in education, with the private sector as a business case, can come into these countries and be a part of that solution. So to give you an example, we're still talking about India, HDFC Bank in India, which today is the fourth largest bank in the world in terms of market cap, was an original investment of the IFC a couple of decades ago, as one example, to create the mortgage finance market in India, and so on. There's many such examples in the IFC's history. But the IFC works principally with the private sector. The fourth part of the institution is the Multilateral Insurance Guarantee Agency. What this does is essentially sell political risk insurance to a private company. So Cisco entering into a country with certain promises from that sovereign about how they would create tariffs or policy and so on, doesn't live up to it. Cisco doesn't realize what it thought it would out of a project. Where do you get political risk insurance? You get it from this institution called MIGA, which in turn lays that off to the private reinsurance market. The fifth part, is what's called ICSID, which is the International Agency for Settlement of Investment Disputes. So if there's an investment dispute between a private company and a sovereign, who do you go to for that settlement? You come to ICSID. That's the five parts of the bank. Put together, about $100, $120 billion a year currently is going out. About half of that to Africa. Africa used to be 15% of the money some time ago. Now it's 50%+. But the other part goes to all the other parts of the world, the developing world. Second big part of the bank is not just the money bank. I call that the knowledge bank. And that's the ability to transfer success and capabilities from one part of the world to the other. So think of five verticals: people, prosperity, planet, infrastructure, digital. And they mean exactly what those words mean. Human capital for people, you know, education and health and social benefit schemes. Prosperity is jobs and economic policy and, you know, domestic resource mobilization and financial inclusion and SME credit and so on. And then planet is climate and mitigation and adaptation and nature and water, and infrastructure is bridges and ports and airports, and digital is what you and I live together on. So those five, we have real knowledge in these spaces. What do you want to know about water? Everything from desalination to conservation to recycling to how to better economize the use of water in agriculture to catering to climate change and heat challenges with water. We have people who understand it, comprehend it, and most importantly, have delivered projects on the ground in countries around the world that make a difference in water. So when we can transfer success from one country to the other, that's our knowledge bank. So a money bank and a knowledge bank, putting about $120 billion to work in a year for the poorest countries in the form of IDA, all the way to the private sector with IFC, insurance guarantees, and settlement disputes is what we do.
What are your top priorities? Which ones do you build upon that people, your predecessors, have done? And what are the areas that you kind of want to take the vision of the World Bank in the future?
So I think the bank's very focused on eradicating poverty and poverty, as well as, you know, creating a shared prosperity. So both eradicating poverty at the bottom end, but also spreading the peanut butter fairly. But I think what's happened over time is that if you look at the challenges we're dealing with in the world, from climate to pandemics and healthcare to fragility, conflict and violence, we are in a world where these challenges are intertwined. You know, I give the example of Kenya, which has not had adequate rainfall for 4 to 5 years.
Yes.
And, you know, in the past, if you had good rainfall, farmers began to have 2 and 3 crops a year. Now with inadequate, you come down to one. When you come down to one, you can no longer afford the cattle that you had over there. You get rid of the cattle, you no longer have the dairy income. You no longer have the dairy income. You can't afford the laborer that you had hired onto the farm. You get rid of the laborer. What do you do now? You get your children out of school, starting typically with your girl child, to work back on the farm again. What is poverty eradication? Trying to get the girl child off the farm into a school so her education gives her a fair chance in the future to the same opportunities that you and I got. That turned back in 4 years of poor rainfall. So trying to segregate climate and its impact from poverty eradication is kind of not a real choice. And the idea of intertwined challenges is why we have changed the vision of the bank to say, yes, we will eradicate poverty, but on a livable planet. By livable planet, we're allowing the bank staff to expand their aperture to look at climate, pandemics, healthcare, fragility, conflict, violence, whatever is the impact in the country that they're in that impacts poverty as well. Expand your lens, expand your view, tackle the thing holistically, because otherwise we are putting Band-Aid on open wounds. And that's the idea.
You know, it's exciting in terms of looking at it. I wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't ask you a question around how do you see the global economy, because you see it in different angles than others. Are there key takeaways in your mind in terms of what you think the next couple of years are most likely to bring?
I mean, John, I think the global economy did better than people expected a year ago. So one thing you do know about predictions is they're likely to be wrong. And so take my prediction with a pinch of salt, or a big pinch of salt. But the reason it did better was not that it did better uniformly across the world. It did better in certain countries. America was a great example, but so did India, so did parts of ASEAN, so did Brazil. On the other hand, some countries got hammered even worse than we expected. And I would count a number of African countries in that category. China had a worse year than people have expected. So there was it's kind of a mixed bag, but on the whole, the world outperformed the forecast that everybody put in. Having said that, the first 5 years of this decade are currently on a pathway to be the slowest growth of the previous 35 years around the world. That's not a good place to be. Because without growth, you don't get prosperity. And I will tell you, you don't get peace. So this is a challenge. And I think that, you know, it's exacerbated by lower levels of investment than we've seen in the past 20, 30 years. It's exacerbated by lower levels of trade than we've seen in the past years. It's exacerbated by a degree of fractional, sort of, you know, fractionalization of the global order, which I don't find attractive. So I think there's a series of things that are headwinds in this economy, while there are still some countries that are doing remarkably better than people had laid out would happen some time ago. So I'm still of the camp that the world will be fine, but we need to worry about this slowdown in growth and how to turn this tide. To give you a dimension on this, the global South, which is blessed with young people, and everybody talks about young people as a demographic dividend. And that is true if when they're growing up, they have clean air, clean water, healthcare and education. And when they are of age, they should get a productive job, a decent job, whatever that be defined as in that country. But John, if you don't have those when you're growing up and you don't have a job when you are of job age, what do you think that demographic dividend translates into? Very quickly, very serious social challenges. And so, you know, currently there's 1 billion people in the global South that are coming through this demographic dividend pipe. And over the next 10, 12 years, that's the number of jobs that need to be created in the global South. Current forecasts are that we were on track to create 350 million jobs in those countries. Now, forecasts are not destiny. Things could change. But we need to work at it because 350 million versus 1 billion is a pretty big gap. And so I think when you look out, you've got to look out beyond 2 years and start thinking about what kind of economy do we need to build to ensure that the power and optimism of these young people, their ability to transform our future, is realized by the health and education and clean air and clean water they get today and the job they get, which gives them the dignity as well as the earning power to be a productive segment of society. That, to me, is the important topic here.
Lots of times we talk about digital transformation and technology, how it's changing the world. When you think about what you just outlined, you hit on digital as a key component part. What does digital transformation mean to you in the sense that you outlined, and what role do startups play in that, and how important is that, especially in the developing nations?
I mean, I think that digital is the technology that takes away the arbitrage of incumbency. So the power of an incumbent to dominate anything gets taken away by digital, because digital breaks through the barriers that incumbents tend to create by building moats around their castle, whether it's in commerce, whether it's in society, whether it's in human development, any of these attributes. So to me, digitization is the miraculous medicine that could drive change. Now, at the bank, there are many aspects of digitization. There's the use of digital technology to transform governance in countries, which I think is actually, from a development institution's point of view, the holy grail. Because if you can bring the ability for governance in a country to deliver for their citizens with transparency, with speed, and the likes that digitization brings, you and I have both been exposed to the use of that in India's governance. And while it's still a journey and it's not complete, the transformation that it's creating is quite remarkable. Where you can today, as a citizen, be able to track where your application is for a house building permit. These are remarkable things that digitization can bring. Governance transformed through the transparency of digitization. Second is the use of digital technology to transform the citizens' capabilities. It started with a digital identity and financial inclusion, But I think it goes way beyond that to how you deliver healthcare and education. I mean, COVID taught us the value of education delivered remotely. Because without that, the learning gaps that we're still trying to fight, can you imagine what they would have been, John, if we weren't able to do at least what we did do during COVID with remote learning? It would have been a disaster. So yes. I think that digitization has a governance angle and a human individual angle. And then there's data and the use of data. And you and I are passionate about how to use data with the right privacy and the right security, but use it and use it for better things, which is what AI is enabling us to do. And I think that all these aspects, governance, individual, and AI and data, are very much a part of what a development institution like us has to embrace over the coming years. In fact, if you remember, I told you about those five verticals in the knowledge bank, and the last one is digital. That's a new vertical that the bank is now creating as a way to ensure that the right focus from all of us goes onto these three topics I just discussed with you.
You know, Ajay, I've got so many areas I want to cover, and I'm taking notes for myself, learning as well. Maybe one last question that I really like asking each of our visitors to share their thoughts on is there a particular lesson in leadership or in management or in technology or the combination of it that you wish you'd learned 20 or 25 years ago that you could share with the group? Because all of us are thinking, for me, I probably wish I'd learned to dream even bigger. And people said I dreamed awful big and tried to do too much. I actually think I should have done it more and had a playbook behind it to move faster. Is there key lessons that you've learned that you wish you had learned earlier? And perhaps many of the listeners today can walk away with your experience and incorporate it into their own learning.
John, I think that the idea, you just talked about something that's the corollary of what I'm going to speak to, the dreaming bigger, thinking bigger. I think the willingness to push your risk capability, to push your risk tolerance, to take risks, to put yourself outside your zone of comfort, to take things a little bit as they come, as compared to trying to plan your next step and the step after that. Because as you and I know, whatever you think your current plans are, they're going to change because events are going to overtake you. So if you think about Cisco or MasterCard, if you planned your career based on today I'm going to do this, 5 years from now I'll do that, 10 years from now I'll do this, you know that John Chambers was going to have changed the entire importance of those jobs in those 10 years because John Chambers was ensuring that Cisco was fit for purpose for the next 10 years. And what worked for the last 10 years probably wouldn't work for the next 10. It's the same in life. Take a risk and put yourself out there. Push your boundaries and be willing to be outside your zone of comfort. You do that well, you will dream bigger. You will end up making a few mistakes and taking a few hard knocks. But so what? You're going to enjoy your life and have no regrets. And why the heck would you look back on a productive life and have regrets?
Completely agree. Ajay, I want to thank you for taking time. I hope that many people walk away with three or four ideas they can incorporate in their future. For me, I've got two pages of notes that I'm going to rethink through. And every time we talk, I learn much from what you share. And you do it so humbly. Don't misunderstand, Ajay can move mountains, but he does it by his people skills and making a difference. I want to thank everyone for listening to the podcast and another episode of Chambers Talks. I would also encourage you to rate the podcast and hopefully give us 5 stars in terms of how you view the value of the platform. And I look forward to talking with all of you on our next episode. Ajay, thank you once again. Very
John, thank you. Thank you for everything you do, John.